Thank you all for coming. I understand this is a non-standard seminar date. So,
every day is a good day to think about what is going to go on. Okay.
Every day is a good day to think about quantum gravity in the Sitter space, right? Because it's the simplest toy model for
both
classes of interesting questions. Right, both for cosmology, with its positive cosmological constant, and for black holes, because it's the simplest geometry that has causal horizons. Okay. Now, before...
Because what we understand the best is quantum gravity radius, the radius CFP. What I'm going to hunt for in this talk is...
A version of it that works with cosmological constant, so the SCFT. And we want it
in the physically relevant bulk direction, which is
DS4, CFT-free. Okay, my favorite thing about the Sitter space is as the unit radius hyperboloid in five-dimensional Minkowski, and that's the language that I'll use throughout. Okay, it's asymptotic infinity is composed of two pieces. There is an initial space-like three-sphere in the past and a final space-like three-sphere in the future. And if you don't know anything and you're told that you want to formulate the SCFT, then obviously what it should do
is to calculate amplitudes for transitions between square minus and square plus.
So there should be some CFT model which calculates
this
in the bulk. This runs into
an immediate problem.
Is there nothing we can do about the echo?
It's a microphone.
Like this far?
Maybe just in the middle.
Just in the middle.
No, no, no.
It has to be on the shirt itself, otherwise
it'd be too narrow. On the shirt itself. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Got it. All right. Okay, now, this is what the SCFT should do. But it can't. Or at least no one understands how. Because a CFT should be local, and it should live on one connected manifold. But here, there are these two disconnected infinities, scry minus and scry plus. So where does it live? And this seems to require both. Now, my favorite answer, which was proposed in 2002 by Eric Relinda and friends, is to take the Sitter and identify everywhere pairs of antipodal is diametrically opposite points, like so. So the Sitter is a glorified sphere. So like every sphere, it has a notion of antipodal points, which in the 5D picture just means mapping the point x to the point minus x. Okay, this is an operation of the CT type in the usual classification of discrete symmetries. So it flips past and future. So there is a T. It doesn't complex conjugate anything, so there is a compensating C. And the space-time orientation encoded in the epsilon symbol gets reversed, so the spatial orientation doesn't. Therefore, there is no P. Now, it's weird on first sight and also on second sight to identify past with future. It breaks time orientation. Turns out that it doesn't break it too badly. So in particular, closed time-like loops in this identified space-time exist, but they're all of infinite length. They all pass through scry. So you need to live an infinite time to see that there is a problem with causality. So the proposal is you take this antipodally identified the sitter divided by the antipodal map, and its boundary is, so in particular, the antipodal map identifies points on scry minus with opposite points on scry plus. So the boundary of this quotient space is a single free sphere, which is scry minus and scry plus identified. And a single free sphere, a CFT can live. So what we can now hunt for is a duality where there is a CFT partition function that eats some background fields. And it should calculate transition amplitudes in the sitter with the initial data phi on scry minus and the same final data phi on scry plus, with the further restriction that the bulk also must be antipodally symmetric. So this is not quite transitions from arbitrary states on scry minus to arbitrary states on scry plus, but it's getting closer. And this construction might have some other perks to it. For example, it's an extreme, super explicit form of black hole complementarity. So people are fantasizing about solutions to the black hole information puzzles where somehow the same information is encoded both on the outside and on the inside of the horizon. So one thing that the antipodal map in the sitter does is it identifies the outside and the inside of every cosmological horizon so that they're literally the same. And now you can spend your time thinking about what that means. Okay, so this is what we want to accomplish. Now, there are some basic restrictions on what the bulk theory can be that simply follow from the fact that the antipodal map is CT. So the identified space is non-orientable. The epsilon gets flipped. So the bulk theory, in order to live on it, must be invariant under P, which is equivalent to invariance under CT. To be consistently defined in the quotient space, or simply for the dynamics to respect the antipodal symmetry, we must arrange the antipodal symmetry of every field to correlate with its intrinsic parity sign. So fields that are even or odd under parity must be antipodally even or odd in order to fit into this picture. Now, this is as far as you can get without explicit models. Now, the worst thing about this set of ideas is that an explicit model doesn't exist. This has been stuck for over 10 years. So what I want to talk about today is an attempt to come up with an explicit model that passes some stupid set of initial tests. What does exist is a proposal by Strominger's group at Harvard from 2011. So So there is a model for DS4 CFT3 that does something else in terms of the bulk. And the paradigm there that has been developed for a while by people like Strominger and Maldacena is that, first of all, you give up on thinking about scry minus. You solve the problem of two infinities by focusing on scry plus. Second, the duality, so it's not calculating transition amplitudes from scry minus to scry plus, then what it is doing is simply calculating a wave function, wave functional of the bulk field values on scry plus. And it's calculating not any old wave function, but the Hartle-Hawking wave function. So the good news, the bad news, is that this kind of model is not doing dynamics in the bulk. The good news is that it can be cooked up just by analytically continuing from ADS CFT. So in a sense, you don't need to invent anything new. So the idea is the following. You look at Euclidean ADS, otherwise known as hyperbolic space. The boundary of this guy is a three sphere, just like the future boundary of the sitter. And in fact, you can view it as another slice of complexified the sitter. So you can say that this is the set of points in the 5D space, which also have unit space like radius. But they're imaginary, and they're imaginary future pointing time rack. So this Euclidean ADS sits in the imaginary future of the DS that we want, and they share the same three sphere as their boundary. And now, you perform a path integral in the bulk, either over real fields in the Euclidean ADS, or if you prefer to think intrinsically in DS, which you should, then you do a path integral over fields that have complex fields that have negative frequency in the Bunch-Davies sense. Either way, you're doing the path integral over Euclidean modes. And you're equating its result to the CFT partition function. The path integral over Euclidean modes is exactly the Hartle-Hawking wave function. The sad news are that in the original Hartle-Hawking proposal, you can find the wave function on any slice in the spacetime, and that, of course, gives you also dynamics. But here, you only find it on scry plus, and that's it. Okay. Now, as I said, there is an explicit model that does this. And analytically continuing from, how does this work? I used to know. Thanks. ADS-CFT is usually a duality between string theory in the bulk and Young-Mills on the boundary. or something similar. Those things you usually cannot analytically continue to positive cosmological constant. Bad things happen. You get the wrong signs in the wrong places, you develop ghosts, and so on. Doing string theory in the sitter is difficult. However, there is another class of magical theories which also have an ADS-CFT associated to them. That is what we want then to analytically continue, what Strominger wants to analytically continue. So we start out from the Euclidean ADS-CFT, where in the bulk there is the theory called higher spin or Vasiliev gravity, which does know how to live with a positive cosmological constant. And on the boundary, you have some simple vector models. Now, what is higher spin gravity? I won't need to say too much about it, but it's a theory that contains an infinite number of fields in a tower of increasing spins that are all massless gauge fields, where the graviton counts as the spin 2 gauge field, and it comes in many different versions. Okay? So it can conserve parity or not. If it does conserve parity, the spin 0 field can have even or odd intrinsic parity. You can take all the integer spins for the fields or only the even ones. On top of the freedom in choosing the bulk theory in the duality, there's also some freedom in choosing the boundary conditions, the fields that you fix at scry. Okay? So for the spin 0 and the spin 1 fields, you can choose different boundary conditions. And all these possibilities lead to different CFTs, which are more or less worked out. So now the question becomes, out of the different versions of the bulk theory and its boundary conditions, what can be made to work in the setup that I want? Okay. So one thing we can say immediately is that you must choose the bulk theory to be parity invariant. That already cuts it down to a few options. Now, what else? So we want to understand how antipodally symmetric fields in the sitter behave. Like, what is a well-posed initial value problem? What do the two-point functions look like? How does the asymptotics play with the antipodal symmetry? Okay, questions like that, simple questions, which I don't think have been addressed generally before. And now the next, oh no. We're doomed. No, we're not. It did the right thing. Smart board. Okay, so the next part of the talk will be purely about gauge fields of different spins in the sitter space. You can forget everything that came before as a relevant motivation. You don't even need to think about the exotics of higher spin gravity. What I'm going to say will also work as special cases in Maxwell Young-Mills GR and theories like that. So what do the bulk fields in these theories look like? So the spin S gauge potential in DS4 is a symmetric tensor with S indices. Now, the free equations we can write in the transverse traceless gauge as just box H S squared minus 2S minus 2H equals 0. Okay. There is secretly a factor of the de Sitter radius for units that's hiding here, but I'm keeping it 1. Now, you can take the S equals 0 special case of this field equation and get an honorary gauge field, which is the M squared equals 2, or conformally coupled, if you prefer, scalar. Okay, and this guy also appears in Vasiliev gravity. Now, from the gauge potentials with the spins greater than 0, you can build generalizations of the Weyl tensor that act as the field strengths. By taking S derivatives of the potential. And these guys are tensors with 2S indices, and they satisfy the symmetries that are obviously generalized from those of the Weyl tensor. Now, the possible boundary conditions at infinity for these two kinds of fields, for the spin 0 and the for the spin greater than 0 are, so a scalar can have Dirichlet boundary conditions, which I'll call phi. So the value at infinity up to some rescaling. And it can have Neumann boundary conditions, the momentum at infinity. And likewise, the field strength can have magnetic boundary conditions and electric boundary conditions, where these guys generalize the electric and magnetic parts of the Maxwell field strength and of the Weyl tensor. So, they have S indices. So we want to understand the solutions of these field equations and how antipodal symmetry plays with the different kinds of boundary data. At the free level, we can just do it by writing down a general solution, or what turns out to be simpler, a spanning set of solutions, and staring at it. Now, which set I choose is not very important, but I found some that look nice. So
question.
Yes?
Don't these kind of equations typically, in the presence of generic curvature, get inconsistencies?
These kind of equations, yes, they do. But they are not in the presence of generic curvature. This is the form of the equations at linearized level on top of pure de Sitter.
Right.
So the interacting equations of the full higher spin gravity are different. And they evade the usual theorems against the higher spin interactions in all sorts of ways, like having an infinite number of fields.
Yeah. So we should think about these in the context that you set out before. In other words, they're only going to ultimately make sense mm-hmm. in the context of this full higher spin theory. Is that right?
Yes. But I will talk about the interacting level in a few minutes. So first I'll say a few things about the free equations, and then I'll bootstrap it to give a result about the interacting equations, which will not care about the precise form of the interactions. So get done.
Since you were interrupted.
Yes.
If S gets big,
yes.
I don't know, three or bigger.
Three, oh no.
Three, you apparently have a tachyon in the sitter space. Something that looks like a tachyon.
So you should be careful with that word.
Okay.
Because
you have a negative mass.
The notion of mass in the sitter, especially when it's mass of the order of the cosmological scale, is tricky. So in normal jargon, you would call all these fields massless. And indeed, their field strengths just satisfy the ordinary equations for massless fields, same as in flat space. Which is this. So if you want, this term pops up from the conformal transformation from flat space to the sitter. But especially when it's a tensor, we need to be careful about interpreting the coefficient as mass. All right. So it turns out to be possible to write a spanning set of simple solutions for to these equations for every spin. And the sharp-eyed among you will see that it's coming from twister theory, but I won't use any such bad language here, and write everything in tensor terms. So the input to the solutions is to take a point in that upper imaginary EADS, which is a slice of the complexified DS, and that will sort of give the point around which the solution is centered. And for the polarization, take a right-handed totally null vector at the point y. Now, I like to write everything in the 5D language, where everything is flat vectors and tensors. So in the 5D space, a point in the four-dimensional the sitter is a vector from the origin. And because it's the Euclidean one, it's imaginary. And this guy is a B vector, which will have to be complex. And now, this I can erase. You can write solutions that are mighty simple. So for the potentials, potential of any spin S is some simple rational function that I know of the invariant scalar product x times y in five dimensions times S factors of the polarization tensor M and the measurement point x. Okay. And for the field strength, you can write the same sort of thing even simpler. So there, the scalar factor is just x dot y minus 1 to the power 2s plus 1. And the tensor factor is also s factors of the same thing. Where these MLs mean that you take M, project it into the 4D tangent space to the sitter at the point x, and project that into the left-handed subspace. Okay. So these guys span all the left-handed negative frequency solutions, positive frequency solutions, By flipping some signs, you can get the right-handed ones and the negative frequency ones. And you can combine them into antipodally symmetric combinations and get the general free solutions that are antipodally even or antipodally odd. And just by staring at the results and seeing what they do at Scry, you get the following. So, antipodally even solutions turn out to be precisely those where, for the scalar, the value at both scries is zero, and the momentum is, of course, antipodally even, so it's the same on scry plus and on scry minus, and it can be anything. Okay. So for the scalar, the antipodally even solutions are in one-to-one to the Newman boundary conditions. For the fields with spin, the corresponding statement is that the electric field at infinity is zero, and the magnetic field is arbitrary up to the usual magnetic Gauss law. And for antipodally odd solutions, it's the opposite. So there is a straight correspondence for all massless gauge fields, including Maxwell and linearized gravity, in the sitter, which maps the type of boundary data on Scry to the antipodal symmetry sign. Now, why should this exist? It makes a lot of sense. Let's see if I learned. No, haven't. Manual. Yeah, this is middle. Terrible. Thanks. Sorry. Yes. So the mechanism behind these relations is just that all these different fields, they are massless in the sense that they propagate along light rays. And all the light rays coming from a point on scry minus, the light cone refocuses at the antipodal point on scry plus. So if information travels only along the light rays, whatever you put in on scry minus, you will get back at the antipodal point. This is in words. This is not saying whether you get plus the same thing or minus the same thing. So what the statement is saying is that it's mapping precisely which kind of boundary data is naturally antipodally even or antipodally odd when sending it along this refocusing light cone. Okay, so this is about free fields. And now we can upgrade the result to perturbative interactions. And heaven forbid, actually working explicitly with the interactions in Vasiliev gravity. So what I'm about to say uses only the De Sitter symmetry of the equations and their parity symmetry. So in particular, it will also be true for theories like Young-Mills and GR. In the sitter, maybe with m squared equals two scalars that are parity invariant. And the statement is the following. So, if you choose boundary data that is either Neumann and magnetic or Dirichlet and electric for respectively parity, even, and odd fields. Okay. So if you choose the correct kind of boundary data for every field depending on their intrinsic parity, then you know two things. So this is in the antipodally identified space. So boundary data and the antipodally identified scry. So one, there is a unique bulk solution, a unique antipodally symmetric bulk solution. And you can know this only from the result on free fields by working in perturbation theory order by order and saying every time that the equation for the next higher order is just a linear equation with sources and decomposing it into a special and the general solution and so forth. And you find that the antipodally symmetric solution, the one that satisfies the same antipodal symmetries as the boundary data, exists and is unique at all orders. And the second statement is that the canonically conjugate data to the one that we fixed. So if we fixed pi and b, then it's phi and e, and vice versa. In this unique solution, the canonical conjugates vanish at first order. Which is another way of saying that all the two-point functions vanish. And this is a straightforward result from the one on the free fields. Okay, so for instance, an antipodally even solution on the free level wants to have only pi and vanishing phi. So to get non-vanishing phi, you need to turn on the interactions. At leading order, phi will vanish. Okay. Now, with all this, we can place some substantial restrictions on the kind of bulk theory to use in our antipodally symmetric DSCFT, and on the kind of boundary data that we can use. And we also learned something about the two-point functions. So the implications for Harrispin holography in DSZ2 will look like this. So first, as we said, the bulk theory must be chosen be invariant. Second, we should choose boundary data that is either Neumann for the scalar and magnetic for all the gauge fields, or Dirichlet for the scalar and magnetic for all the gauge fields, depending on whether scalar is parity even or parity odd. Okay? The gauge fields are always parity even in Vasiliev theory, so For them, the boundary data should always be magnetic. And once we did that, we know that the two-point functions vanish. And this is the reason why we should only choose this preferred kind of boundary data, because if we choose the canonically conjugate boundary data, then the two-point functions will do the opposite. They will explode. And in fact, the action as a functional of the boundary data will have fractional powers. And the usual endpoint function expansion that we use to talk about correlators and such things will break down. So only for this boundary data, there is a good endpoint function expansion. And it just happens to start from the three-point functions, at least. The two-point functions all vanish. All right, so now we can go and map this to what we know in higher spin ADS CFT. So these two facts restrict us to a particular corner of the ADS CFT zoo. And in that corner, the CFTs are all free. Okay? There are still four different models that you can talk about, but in all of them, the CFT is just a free vector model. Now, the last point, that the two-point functions should vanish, means that we can't just take the ADS CFT model and run with it. We need to change something, because in the existing models, the two-point functions don't vanish. So all right, and herein ends the safe part of the talk. So, it's a good idea to try and build a holographic duality in antipodal de Sitter. If you want to do it by basing yourself on the higher spin ADS CFTs, which can be made to work with positive cosmological constant, then you must restrict to a small corner of the models. The CFT is free. But then you will have to make at least some small change to get the correct answer for the two-point functions. And what I'm going to do in the last 15 minutes is to show you a model that does this. So it passes these simple criteria, and I don't know if it passes any others. So I'll show you how to modify in a rather stupid way the existing dualities to incorporate the vanishing two-point functions. So actually, the zeroth order modification that has to be done is the everything in time. So an explicit CFT model. First of all, how does this corner of the dualities work in ADS CFT? And let me restrict here to the simplest kind of theory in the bulk, where the spins, or there are only even spins, and the scalar is parity even. But I can play this game also for the other versions. So in ADS CFT, the CFT Lagrangian corresponding to this setup is just the free vector model of n scalar fields, chi i's, where this is a metric in field space. So the model has an O(n) symmetry. And the gauge fields in the bulk are dual to a set of spin S currents, which are the tower of conserved currents in this theory that is invariant under the O(n). And they have the schematic form G field times S derivatives field plus some other arrangements of the derivatives that make this guy traceless and conserved. Okay, so that's the ADS-CFT story. Now, in the Harvard DS-CFT, the one that is analytically continued from there and that calculates the Hartle-Hawking wave function, what happens is, turns out that when you flip the sign of the cosmological constant, you need to flip the sign of the number of fields in. And the way they do it is by switching from the orthogonal group with a symmetric metric to a symplectic group with an anti-symmetric metric. So now the new CFT Lagrangian is half an anti-symmetric omega, grad chi, where now the chi's must be Grassmann variables. They're anti-commuting. But otherwise, everything's the same. The currents dual to the bulk fields are the same sort of thing. Omega chi S derivatives. The bulk slash boundary correlators are just one-loop diagrams. One loop because the theory is free, there are no other contributions, with the insertions of these currents. And in particular, there is a diagram for the two-point function, which is non-vanishing. Now, what do I want to do? So the first thing that must change is just the I factor in front of the action. So there you have a Euclidean path integral. And I want transition amplitudes. So the path integral must be rewritten in terms of e to the I action and not e to the minus action. But that doesn't help me with the two-point function. So what I'm proposing is to leave the actual CFT, the fields and their action, just as they were, but to map a different set of operators to the bulk fields. So to put a different symplectic metric, big omega, here. So I'm proposing a model that is like a monster with the head of a lion and the body of a lion, but of a different lion. Okay? So the theory is invariant under one symplectic group, and the currents are the operators invariant under a different one. And this trick can be played only in the corner of the duality space that I picked out. only for the free theories. Because only for the free theories, anything you write in the current here will still be conserved. Because the field equations don't care about the metric. The field equations just say that the Laplacian of everything vanishes. So whatever you put here will be conserved, and interactions will violate that. Also, there are different choices of boundary conditions where the ON or SPN symmetry becomes gauged, and then you are forced to only look at operators that are invariant under it. But here the symmetry is global. So the restriction to singlets is arbitrary, and I can restrict to singlets under something else. So it now remains to choose the new omega. So the simplest thing to write is in blocks of quarter n and quarter n to pick the omega in the action as something like this, and the omega in the currents as something like this. Now, what happens with the correlators? So the endpoint function of the currents is one loop diagram with n legs, where every propagator contributes a color factor of inverse small omega from the Lagrangian, and every current insertion contributes a big omega from the definition of the current. So the color factor for the whole thing goes as a trace of inverse omega times omega to the power of legs, like so. And for this choice of omegas, this is the cosine of n pi half, which is the simplest thing that vanishes for the two-point function. Okay. So this is the proposal. Take the known duality that lives in the correct corner of the bulk theory space and the space of boundary data, tweak it in the minimal way so that the two-point functions become what they must be in the antipodally symmetric story, and hope for the best. So now what one should do is to test this slash correct it by applying any of the tests that the original ADS CFTs went through. Now, unlike in the Hartle-Hawking proposal, it's not just an analytical continuation of the same thing. So evidence for the ADS CFT doesn't analytically continue into evidence for this duality. So things like three-point functions should be tested from scratch. Okay. So that's the story. So let's try to make DS CFT actually calculate dynamics in DS. Thank you.
Questions?
This is a very trivial question. Do you mean n pi over 4 or something like that? Or?
Yes, of course I do. Yeah, sorry.
But then I was confused on several. So at some point you went on in this corner of the CFTs and you said they were all free. Mm-hmm. Is that because people don't, I guess those were the ones that satisfied your parity conditions? Is that what was driving you?
Yes, yes.
So is it that no one knows any ones that are not free, or you can actually prove that they must be free?
So with different versions of the higher spin gravity in the bulk and with and or with different boundary conditions, they're not free. So the corner that I singled out is just four possible combinations. Choose the spins to be only even or all integers, and choose the scalar to be parity even or parity odd. For these four combinations, it's a free CFT.
So you're not forced to do free, but free is convenient for the later development. Is that right?
Well, it's both. If I want to closely follow the known dualities, then the restrictions that I find for the bulk theory and the boundary conditions leave you just with the free CFTs. And it allows me to do what I'm doing.
So it's actually a theorem that they must be free with when you put these conditions? Or it's just
that? Yes, under the assumption that you really want to import everything you know from the ADS case and make a minimal adjustment rather than inventing something completely new.
Then another question I had was your CFT, I mean, it starts off on a Euclidean signature space, but
yes.
You want to reinterpret it as you want to do an analytic continuation and reinterpret it as a Lorentzian theory?
So
what exactly is meant by transition amplitude?
Good. So the CFT lives on the space-like free sphere,
right.
Scry, and I'm not touching that. On the space-like free sphere, there is no such thing as transition amplitudes. You just calculate path integrals and sometimes call the result a partition function. There is such a thing as a transition amplitude in the bulk, which is Lorentzian. In the bulk, there is a past and the future, up to maybe the fact that you made them the same, but yes. but there is a transition along a Lorentzian time direction. You just want the CFT path integral to calculate that. And I was saying that the only way for that to have a chance is if you make the CFT amplitudes oscillating by putting e to the I action, a lot like what is done for different reasons in Euclidean spin foams. So the CFT lives on a space-like manifold, but I give it an oscillating amplitude. So there's no conventional physical interpretation to anything that happens in the CFT. It violates everything that you can possibly want. It violates spin statistics.
That was my next question.
Yes. but that's okay, because that's not the space-time we're living in.
In particular, you don't mind that it violates spin statistics?
No. Because spin statistics follows from things like causality in Lorentzian spacetime.
But on the boundary, you haven't violated causality. Well, I'm not sure what it means, but anyway, I mean, this is radically different from anything that would be, I guess, obtained by analytic continuation from CFT.
Yes, analytic continuation gives e to the minus action. Just like you have in Euclidean ADS.
So then you interpret this as a transition amplitude from something to itself. Is that still the same
yes.
language?
Yes.
Check the three-point function.
Absolutely, let's do that.
Since it's just one amplitude, it's one data point, so it's not two splines and you can fit it. So I'd be more interested in the like in the earlier story, they could do three-point functions as well. I guess the gravity calculation is more complicated with elliptic.
Yes, the problem is, of course, the gravity calculation. I don't know that it's more complicated than the calculation that was already done in Euclidean ADS. It's just different, and you have to do it again.
More questions?
Good. I mean, well, okay, maybe it's in line with Paul's question about investigating further, but because all the two-point functions vanish, that means we're working with something with zero central charge, which, well, it's a weird theory. I don't know. I'm worried how far we can really go with this. I mean, are any concepts like the conformal primary, you know, do those even apply here? Or?
Well, okay, so these guys are conformal primary. If you don't do any funny things like
right.
Changing the coefficient matrix. Now I go and change it. Now, I'm a bit of an ignoramus in these things, what is actually called a CFT and what's not. So what's happening here, both in the original duality and in mine, is that you're taking the actual field theory with its action, and then you're restricting to a subset of operators, which as far as the CFT itself is concerned, you don't have to do. Right? So in particular, you can put any matrix here, and it will be also a primary in the single trace primary in the CFT, and you can calculate correlators for those. The statement is just that it's only, so you need only one operator per spin to map to the gauge fields in the bulk, and you should choose these. What happens to the standard CFT terminology when you truncate the set of operators? I just don't know.
But one might have thought that you had, I mean, in your original theory, when it was a global symmetry, I think you're hinting that there are lots and lots of currents that could have defined, but somehow, you know, the consistency of, you know, the operator product expansion or four-point amplitude, four-point function, you know, somehow forces us to pick out a subset. And yeah, so it might be interesting to see if your projection is somehow consistent.
Yes.
Although your four-point functions are all zero. So, yeah.
No, the six-point functions are zero.
The six-point
functions. It's modulo four.
Functions are, oh, okay.
Yeah, so this is, yeah, again, the only intelligent thing I can say is that it's an artifact of the projection. If you allow all the other operators, they'll have the generic two-point function is non-zero.
If we go back to the scalar field, for example, does this correspond to any different kind of vacuum for this sitter, like one of the alpha vacuum, or is that not a well-posed question?
It's a definitely well-posed question. So the m squared equals 2 scalar is special in this regard, in that it plays well with the antipodal symmetry, so it has solutions that have, say, vanishing Dirichlet data both in the past and in the future. And in terms of the language of different vacua, that would say that it has a special kind of vacuum in which there is no particle production, where things on Scry minus look just like they do on Scry plus. Now, it turds out that this corresponds to a value of alpha in the alpha vacuum scheme, which makes it singular. So the Bogoliubov transformation from any ordinary vacuum to this one is singular. And on top of, so if you view it as a state on top of an ordinary vacuum, then it's a non-normalizable state. And Strominger's group have written about this.
So let's think Kirsch again.